To find out what's really going on behind the music, sometimes you have to dig deep. I'm Dr. Mike, and on the new season of Going There, we're doing just that.
Art or music can be your escape and your therapy.
Going There is the podcast at the crossroads of music and mental health, where we have raw, meaningful conversations with artists like Noah Kahn, Julian Baker, Jason Isbell, Youngblood, The Head and the Heart, and Bishop Briggs.
I recently heard someone describe grief as glitter, where you'll clean it up and then you'll find little pieces.
By opening ourselves up to these real discussions about mental health, we can foster understanding and gain even greater appreciation for the music we all love.
For me, like, my favorite songs give me happy tears.
So join me and some of your favorite artists on the new season of Going There with Dr. Mike, brought to you by SoundMind Live and the Consequence Podcast Network. Subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. This is Aaron Carnes, the host of this podcast. After 4.5 years of weekly episodes, we are ready to stop creating In Defense of Ska. The podcast was meant to be a promotional push for my book In Defense of Ska, and it wound up taking on a life of its own. While Adam and I both love what we've accomplished with this podcast, we both feel compelled to focus our creative output elsewhere. The episodes we recorded remain evergreen, and we invite you to explore our back catalog, which will remain online thanks to the Consequence Podcast Network. I am working diligently on a new book, a novel called Little Black Book of Death. It's not ska-related, but it has a strong musical component. I also have a punk-themed script in the works. Adam is working on new music for Omnigon. We invite you to follow our respective projects and look forward to what the future holds. To keep in touch with my writing, follow me on Substack. That's aaroncarnes.substack.com. You can follow Omnigon on their social media accounts. Thank you.
Consequence Podcast Network.
This is In Defense of Ska. Our mission is to document the ska scene from its traditional roots through until its emergence as a diverse global genre. The influence of ska resonates through your favorite bands and artists in ways you might have missed. I'm your co-host, Adam D., of Omnigon and Asian Man Records band, Link 80. Joining me is your host, Aaron Carnes, renowned author of the book In Defense of Ska.
So my band Flat Planet, we didn't have a lot of contemporaries. And by contemporaries, I mean bands from the South Bay in Northern California and our age. I mean, one of those was Slow Gherkin, for sure, which we talked to very early in this podcast. But one of the other main contemporary bands for Flat Planet was a band called Janitors Against Apartheid. So today we're going to talk to the Janitors sax player, Lodge Worcester. I don't know how many times I've seen Janitors play live. I know it's a lot. How about yourself?
I saw them a few times. I don't think I saw them as many as you did.
Yeah.
But they were great. I saw them when they still had MC Loaf as the singer.
Mm-hmm.
And then I saw them when Lodge became the singer. And then I saw them when they became the Adjustments. Basically, they were on the Bay Area Ska Comp that Flat Planet was also on. But they did that tour as the Adjustments. Even though it was Janitors on the CD, I think.
Yeah, because it kind of caught them in a transitional period, which it actually caught us, Flat Planet, in a transitional period, because those recordings have me on them, but I wasn't in the band by the time Bay Area Ska Comp came out.
Well, and Mike Vianelli, but since I did the layout, I put pictures of me.
Oh, Adam.
Yeah.
So Janitors Against Apartheid formed in Cupertino, California. I think it's Cupertino. It could have been Saratoga. I don't know. South Bay, let's just say.
Yeah.
In 1992. The group were never huge, but they toured a bunch and put out several releases. Flat Planet played with them a bunch. In fact, I mentioned them in my book, In Defense of Ska. The thing about Janitors that I will always remember is that they were one of the wildest and weirdest ska bands from the entire 90s ska punk era. It would be near impossible to relay exactly how strange their shows were. And also, Lodge and I are currently working on a project, which we will also talk about today.
So let's hop right into our conversation with Lodge.
In my research, I found an Omnigon post where Adam said that his ska punk influences were Flat Planet, Skank and Pickle, Crack, and Janitors Against Apartheid.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in the South Bay, so that was my limited scope of things ska. You know, not all those things were great, but, you know, that was the lens I was seeing ska through.
What town did you grow up in?
I grew up in Gilroy with Mr. Aaron Carnes, which is why Flat Planet was my entry point to ska.
Do you remember your first janitor show?
It was probably at Berkeley Square. There was probably a Burt doll being thrown into the audience, if I remember right.
We had some really good Berkeley Square shows. We got to...
Yeah. What do you remember about Berkeley Square?
I remember Bailey, the dude that booked the shows. He was always really nice to us. And gosh, we played with Rudiments there a bunch. And who else did we play with there? I think Voodoo probably.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were always packed. It was always a lot of fun. You know, just total hole in the wall, like, you know, graffiti all over the walls in the back and dirty and gross and perfect.
Did Bailey ever hop on stage and jam out with janitors?
I think he did, actually. Yeah. he really liked us. He liked both incarnations of janitors, with MC Loaf and then post MC Loaf. They're the two very distinct eras for us.
Yeah.
But we're not going to be doing an eras tour, so get your hopes up.
So I want to talk about a story that is in Defense of Ska, my book. And it's kind of more the tail end of janitors, and that's the lawsuit you had with Nestle.
Yeah.
So can you kind of walk everyone through the story of Nestle and the lawsuit?
Sure. So us being from the South Bay, we were really excited when Dill Records wanted to put out some of our music. Skank and Pickle was our idols. And Michael Liu, who was in our band, also happened to work for Dill. So I think that helped us get our foot in the door there. And they put out a split album with us and One Eye Open, Riverside County, crazy, weird punk, sometimes ska, just like all over the place band. Really, really cool band. And we played shows with them in like at the Cupertino Library and a couple of, you know, the random South Bay venues where we would hold shows. So it comes time to put together the album artwork, and we see the proof, and it's a Nerd's candy box, like just completely lifted, you know, with purple on one side and pink on the other side. Not really any attempt to really change it whatsoever. And even the Willy Wonka logo was like on there. It was a pretty blatant copyright infringement. But this was, you know, this is the 90s. This is the mid 90s. This is like the era of what everybody was doing that. You know, it was like you go into, you know, any shop and they would have all these t-shirts that were just ripoffs of corporate logos, like, you know, Far From Poopin' and, you know, things like that.
Do you know whose idea was the Nerds cover?
I'm pretty sure it was Michael Liu's.
Okay.
I don't want to speak out of turn, but I'm pretty sure.
Okay.
And my dad saw it. He's like, you're going to get sued. And we're like, yeah, we'll be fine. So we put out the split, and it did pretty well. Dill had really good distribution, and down here, I live in LA, and in Glendale, there's a Borders store. Is Borders still around? I don't even know if it is. I don't think it is. But it's like a bookstore, and they had a music section also. And it just happened to be a block down from the Nestle headquarters. Nestle is the parent company of Willy Wonka Candies. So one of their employees was, you know, browsing around at Borders, and they saw the CD sitting on the shelf and immediately brought it to the attention of the corporate, Nestle corporate. And that was sort of the beginning of the end for Dill Records and for us as a band also. They tried to serve us papers at all of our shows. They would follow us all over the states. Like, they tried to get our bass player up at Petaluma at the Phoenix Theater. They got some of us at the Alligator Lounge down in Santa Monica.
Didn't they pose as like they were record scouts or something like that?
Yes, that's how they got us at the Alligator Lounge. They said, we're here representing Motown Records. We're like, Motown Records? That's pretty random, but okay, we'll talk to you. And they got half of us that day. And they proceeded to follow us around. They found out like where I lived in college, and it was an unlisted residence. They would call me at my friends' houses. Like they somehow knew where I was and how to get a hold of me. And they would try to call me and threaten me. You know, it was pretty wild. I can't imagine Nestle came out on top, like dollars wise. I think they just spent a lot of money to make it go away. And so we finally had this big meeting with, it was all the members of Skank and Pickle and all the members of Janitors. They never got a hold of One Eye Open because, smartly enough, they put pseudonyms on the CDs, like joke names. So they never got a hold of One Eye Open.
They couldn't figure out who they were.
They got up scot-free.
Well, you guys used to have pseudonyms, though, so how come you guys weren't using the pseudonyms?
I think we had our real names and then our pseudonyms were in quotes.
Oh.
If I remember correctly.
And didn't One Eye Open, weren't they like living in their car too? Like permanently on tour, like kind of thing?
Yeah, they had this white, it was a white minivan, but like a cargo minivan with no windows. And so they would all pile in there with all their stuff and they were living in that thing and just touring around, and they were crazy. Yeah, they were such a great live act. But actually, before this, we did the record release party of Nerds at Los Gatos Teen Center. Did you guys ever go to shows there?
Yes, I did go to a show there. Yeah.
Yes. Was that the outhouse?
Yeah, the outhouse. Yeah, exactly. It's right behind the high school.
Adam and I saw Wesley Willis there.
Oh, nice. When I opened, flew down for the record release. The trip down, they came in full costume as like a glam rock band. So they were at the airport with wigs and like leather, you know, full leather get-ups and studs and all that kind of stuff. And in character with British accents the whole trip. They never went out of character. They showed up at the show and their band was called Glass Calendar that night. And so they performed as Glass Calendar, all the One Eye Open songs, but they never broke character the whole time. It was pretty funny, pretty well. There's a video of that somewhere, but I haven't seen it. Anyway, so for the lawsuit, we sat in this boardroom in San Francisco with these corporate lawyers and basically and Skank and Pickle's lawyer, Dill's lawyer. And the settlement was we had to surrender all of the CDs, all of our merchandise. We had all of our t-shirts were printed with the Willy Wonka logo on them, which I personally paid for. I took a big, big hit for that. So we tried to play some shows to raise the money to pay that debt off, but the band ultimately just disintegrated after that. It was pretty disheartening. So,
and so this caused Dill to take a hit as well then, huh?
It killed Dill Records. Yeah. They still put out, they re-released the CD actually as 1 in 3,000 Nerds Can't Be Wrong. Mm-hmm. They did like 3,000, whatever the pressing was, 3,000 copies or something. And they put out a couple more things, but that pretty much just financially, I think it really like did them in. So Dill was done. And then Asian Man started. So
yeah.
Phoenix from the ashes.
So the other thing that was in my book, Janitors related, was I distinctly remember going to this show at Foothill College to see Janitors. Do you remember that show?
I do.
Because what I just remember, you guys had big wheels and you guys had stuffed animals and you were just tearing apart the stuffed animals and you were just riding around the big wheels. And I was like, in my memory, I'm like, I feel like they played a couple songs, but I don't even remember it being like that much music. I just remember it just being like, and I remember watching the promoter, watch you guys being like, oh my God, what did I agree to?
He was just thinking about how much he would have to clean up because there was stuffed animal guts just like all over the dance floor.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was pretty wild. Like we were, I think I was 15 when we started. Mm-hmm. I actually wasn't an original member. The band was around for a couple months before I joined. And at first, I mean, most of us had no business playing music in front of people whatsoever, like just beginning our instruments. Not me necessarily, but it was pretty awful. I mean, like in terms of, you know, musical ability. So I think we tried to compensate by just being as crazy as we could possibly be.
Yeah.
And it got pretty crazy. There was, and our singer was MC Loaf was this, you know, he was probably 6'5", you know, skinny guy whose voice sounded like Kermit the Frog. And, just, it was just a weird, a weird concept, and we just sort of went with it, and there were really no rules.
Now he worked at an arcade, right? Loaf.
He did, yeah, yeah. There's an arcade around the corner in technically, I think it's Saratoga, wherever it's right around the corner from where we went to high school, and you know, that's why half of our songs were about video games, and you know, we spend a lot of time in the arcade.
I feel like I remember that being part of like the janitor's story at the time. It's like, oh, that singer, he works at an arcade. I don't know why that was a big deal, but it was.
He worked in an arcade, and when I could, I think I started working after that in a burger joint called Kirk's. It's like a South Bay like chain.
Oh, I remember Kirk's. Yeah,
yeah. And so, kind of how we started having a relationship with Skank and Pickle was Mike Parkwood. He would go to the arcade and get free tokens, and he would come to the burger place and trade us cassettes of bands that had sent to Dill. He would trade us for food, and the other guys worked at Little Caesars, which other half of our songs were about. And he'd trade for Little Caesars, and so we had this little like barter system going with Mike Park, and that's how we got to know him. And
yeah,
yeah, it's pretty funny.
Are we not talking about the Little Caesars songs? I mean, it's 2025. I'm not trying.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, that's part of the reason where, like, there has been talk of doing like reunion shows and stuff like that. But I'm just like, listen, I'm a 40 whatever year old man. Late 40s at this point, like with kids, like I can't be on stage singing about, you know, making love to pizza dough. Like, it's just not, I'm not going to be doing that. I'm sorry. Yeah. First of all, I didn't write those lyrics, so I can at least claim I sang them plenty of times, but that was a long time ago.
Yeah.
Well, and every time I ran into MC Loaf in San Jose, he always seemed really nonplussed to be connected back to janitors.
It wasn't a friendly parting of ways with him. It wasn't really like, I don't know. He just one day didn't want to be in the band anymore. And he made that pretty obvious. He was still playing with us, but he just wasn't into it anymore. And like, we still wanted to keep going. And we knew that, you know, part of what was the draw for our band was this crazy like singer guy. You know, you couldn't take your eyes off him on stage. So how do you replace that? And we never really like, I never had intentions of singing, being the singer. I just sort of like fell into my lap and we just kept going. And, you know, I think the last time I actually, we've since like, you know, connected on social media and stuff like that. But the last time I saw him, we live like three blocks from each other in Saratoga. And, he was riding his bike and I pulled over in my car. I was like, hey, how you doing, man? He's like, good, good. I said, right when Nerds was released, I said, did you hear the new CD? He's like, yeah. And frankly, I'm not impressed. So.
Yeah. I saw him after he left the band. I saw him at Palookaville in Santa Cruz at a Tortoise show.
Yeah.
And I hadn't seen him since like, I saw him being janitors, and I swear, like the like going from being like a ska weirdo to being a full on like indie rock hipster, that was like the biggest swing I'd ever seen. He just looked like so hipster. I was like, wow, I can't believe that the singer of Janitors went full on like hipster. I mean, I was at the Tortoise show too, but you know, I was never cool. But
he always had that in him. Like he was always a big fan of Morrissey and like. I want to say like Smashing Pumpkins and The Cure and that kind of stuff. Like we had a really wide range of musical taste. So he always had that side of him.
Yeah.
I think the janitors thing, he was like a really talented, like, graphic artist too. Like he was an artistic dude. So he always had like that indie kind of thing going too. So I think it was just another part of who he was. And
mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know, off stage, he was not nearly as crazy as he was on stage.
I ran into him at Streetlight Records once, and let me back up. I ran into him at a record store that he worked at, like a cool little hip indie record store, and I bought a Trackstar 7-inch, which is a cool indie band. And he was really excited about that. And then when I brought up Janitors, his face just immediately fell. Yeah. And then I ran into him another time at Streetlight during like a band was playing, and he was there flyering his new band. And I remember I approached him about it and tried to ask him about the show. And he's like, "Oh, are you over 21? And I was like, "No." He's like, "Oh, it's a 21 and over show." And then he just kind of wandered away from me. And I was like, "Cool."
Yeah, he wanted nothing to do with us.
Yeah. I mean, it happens, you know, I mean, it happens a lot of people that you get into your 20s and like your sense of self and your music taste are just really, really changed. I mean, it's not everyone has like such a huge shift, but that happens to some people.
Yeah.
It's like whatever you were doing as a teenager, you want like nothing to do with that anymore.
He was also older than the rest of us too, by a couple of years. Mm. And so it doesn't seem like a big age gap, but when you're like 16 and he's 19, there's a pretty big difference, you know. I mean, and so not to say that any of us were like super mature in any way whatsoever, but he was definitely probably more mature than the rest of us in a lot of ways. The rest of us pretty much went to high school together in the same class. We were just crazy. Like we were just wild, wild children. And so, you know, yeah, like, I'm really glad there wasn't YouTube back then. I'll say that. There's a couple, you can find a couple of clips here and there. Nothing incriminating. So
you're glad you didn't have an opportunity.
What about the breakfast pastry video from 1994?
That's around. Yeah.
Who made that?
That was Michael Liu, who's the director of that.
Wasn't that like a De Anza college class project?
I think so. I wasn't in it because I was down at college in LA, so I didn't make an appearance in the breakfast pastry video.
How did that song? So that song is, for anyone that hasn't heard it, it just says like breakfast pastry looks mighty tasty. And then it's like these long sections of like Star Wars songs. So how did the Star Wars part of that come together?
That came from me because at the earliest incarnation, I played sax and keyboard, mm-hmm. and sang some background vocals. And I was in the marching band, and our horn section was all in the marching band. So, and we loved, I mean, who doesn't love the Star Wars score, right? All that John Williams stuff. And so I don't even remember how I came with the idea. I think Pete was just playing. It's just basically one chord. Just like he was playing the upbeat. And so like I just started just playing, you know, one of the Star Wars themes. And then we added another one. Then we added another one. I don't even remember how Breakfast Pastry came from. That was a Dave thing because MC Loaf. It was one of his shticks, but he would have like a bag of pastries or bagels and he would just start like eating them as fast as he could. Like, you know, like Cookie Monster, like food flying everywhere. And somehow that breakfast pastry looks mighty tasty was coined. And
yeah,
there you go.
And the video, the concept of the video, I know you said you had nothing to do with it, but the concept of the video is that there's a little kid who's like a breakfast pastry thief. And so each section, this kid is stealing a different member of Janitor's breakfast pastries.
Yeah.
Which was hilarious.
Where is that kid now?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Who is that kid?
That was Michael's girlfriend's little brother, I believe, was where that at the time. Yeah, he's just as famous as the Nirvana Nevermind kid.
Do we know? Yeah, do we know what happened to him? The breakfast pastry kid?
No idea. Pretty sure I never met the kid.
In Defense of Ska will return in a moment.
So I interviewed you for the Nestle story. That wasn't in the first edition of In Defense of Ska, but when I was updating the second edition, I connected with you And I got that story and I put it in there. And in the conversation, I think you were like, hey, I'm working on a script. You know, if you ever want to, if you want to work on it or whatever. And I was like, yeah, I actually, that sounds fun. And I think you were saying too, at the time you were like, it was kind of like that. It's like with janitors and stuff, you had experienced all these bizarre, like almost like hard to believe stories. And that's kind of was like your thought of like why you wanted to write a script. This is before we started working together.
That and like my original inspiration was I came back to the South Bay for Thanksgiving. I think it was a couple Thanksgivings ago. And I was driving around. I mean, it's changed so much since those days. I mean, that was like Silicon Valley was just first starting. There were still apricot orchards, you know, all over Cupertino and not as many. They were disappearing, but they were still, it was just a different time and very different demographic, like whatever. And I was driving around, but there were still like those little places, you know, it's like, oh, there's Streetlight Records or, you know, whatever. I started thinking about, you know, the South Bay punk scene at that time, mm-hmm. which the janitors were very much part of, even though we were like ska punk, there weren't a lot of ska influenced bands in that scene. It was mostly punk, but like our first show or one of our first shows was at a pizza parlor with No Use for a Name, like just so random. But I just started thinking about, you know, there's lots of, you know, there's documentaries and shows and books about the East Bay punk scene, but there's really not a lot about South Bay, if any, that I know of. And we did have our own scene, you know, it was a distinct separate scene that was, you know, grown from nothing. And there weren't a ton of bands that made it out, you know, there was no Green Days out of the batch, but you know, we had, you know, Lars Fredriksson was hanging around and he lived in Campbell, which is just the next town over. And anyway, I just started thinking about that and wanted to tell the story of, you know, basically an unsuccessful punk band from that scene, but telling the story of the scene and the familyhood that was involved and the kind of outcast kids that were all a part of it.
Yeah, so I mean, and so we've been working on this for a while and hopefully it comes to fruition soon, but I guess, you know, like my part of my interest too, I guess I'm Flat Planet was technically a South Bay band, but you know, sort of Gilroy's kind of like far away.
May as well have been on the moon.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you guys were around. I mean,
yeah, we were around. I mean, cause that's Santa Cruz and San Jose are the closest places for us. So of course, like, you know, we're going to try to get to play shows up there. So, and I liked the idea too, cause I liked the idea of, I think like when I think about punk bands in movies and TVs, I feel like in TV shows, I feel like I rarely ever see punk portrayed in a way that's actually accurate.
Yeah.
Like they're always framed as these like edgy troublemakers. And I feel like that's sort of a component, but it's not really the full story. Like a lot of kids get into punk just because they have like, cause they're political, because they have no, like, cause they have family problems. Like they create a community and it's generally a positive thing, not like this negative thing. So that was definitely, when you started telling me about the idea, that was definitely my thought process of like wanting to see that in a show, because it just doesn't really seem much like that, how punk, especially in the 90s, was that's what punk was and probably continues to be.
A lot of kids. So the collective where we were was called the Sunnyvale Music Club. And I didn't start it, but it was started by a handful of, I don't even know really who officially started. It was just a handful of guys that were in bands and girls that were in bands. And there was nowhere to play. It was, you know, 21 and over places. There was the Edge in Palo Alto, right? But which was all ages, but you had to get in there was tough. We eventually cracked that and, you know, got to play with Fishbone and No Doubt and all that kind of stuff. But like, you know, just to get in there was hard. And One Step Beyond is another club down there, which was like pay to play kind of place. Mm-hmm. So we just started booking our own shows at pizza parlors and churches and library community rooms and wherever we could get some of authority to agree to let us play. We would do that and we would get banned from most of the places eventually because, you know, I don't think they would expected it to be as loud as it was and as, you know, mosh pits and that kind of stuff in a pizza parlor. But a lot of the kids, you know, came from divorced families. You know, that area is pretty wealthy now, but it wasn't nearly as affluent back then as it is now. You know, lots of apartment buildings and, you know, single mom houses and stuff and, you know, latchkey kids. So that was sort of the group. It was just, you know, kind of outcasts that wanted to find their people. And it was pretty cool.
Now I remember, was it the Cupertino Library? I think you mentioned that already.
Yeah.
That's the venue I really remember and really associate with janitors. Can you explain now, did you guys start putting on shows there? You guys yourselves, or was it other people first?
I feel like that might've been us. The Cupertino Library might've been us.
Mm-hmm.
So the Cupertino Library is in the center of Cupertino, and they have like sort of a basement level that you can access from the outside. And it's just this big empty room. It's like a community room. And we started doing shows there, all ages, obviously. I'm sure they were free at first. And then maybe with like a couple bucks. Actually, I don't know if we were allowed to charge. I can't remember. We might not have been allowed to charge. But, you know, they quickly grew and actually the incident that got us banned from there, there's probably like 20 or 30 shows there. When I Open is the first time we played with When I Open. Actually, I'm not even sure we played, but When I Open definitely played. And it was packed. And somebody got a hold of the fire extinguisher and just, you know, started spraying it. It's this packed room with like, probably 150 kids in there, you know. And that was sort of the end of the Cupertino Library years. But that was sort of the story of that scene, is like we would find venues and we'd play at them until we get kicked out. Just have to find more and more places. So, we played in church, literally played in like the middle, like a churches, like on the, you know, the stage of a church.
Did they make you guys do the group prayer thing first?
No, I don't even know how they got the church to agree to it. Cause it wasn't like a separate part of the church. It was the main,
it was in the church.
Area of the church. Yeah. Inside the church, you know, stained glass. And it was just pretty wild.
The Sunnyvale Music Club. Can you remember what bands were part of that collective?
Yeah. So some of the bigger ones were like, Corrupted Peasant Farmers, KPF.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, I don't know if people will know a lot of these names because they're popular locally and they were on all the comps and stuff, but they, I'm not sure how far they got outside of the Bay Area. Drippy Drawers was another one.
Well, I remember Drippy Drawers, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, No Use for a Name was there briefly at the beginning, but I think they moved on and got bigger pretty quickly. A lot of what we would do was, we started being able to attract touring bands. So, and bands from the East Bay too, like Green Day played at the Saratoga Lanes. That was an amazing experience. And like 15 and, you know, there's just so many bands. It was that would kind of come and go. There was a lot of like, you know, the bands that only play a few shows and then members from certain bands would like form another band and they would play. And it was a very like, yeah, it was an interesting scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, I don't know right now our script is called Sunnyvale Music Club, whether or not that stays the name, but at this point, that's its name. And I liked that idea too, because you guys have having this collective and these bands that kind of like help build this DIY scene. And of course, obviously the Cupertino Library and all that stuff. I just think it's really fascinating. And again, not super tapped into this idea of like what actually a DIY scene is and how kids create DIY scenes out of anything they can. And it's, yeah, you know, it's just whatever they have access to is what is their scene, essentially.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, just built out of nothing and without anybody's help,
mm-hmm.
just the love of music and wanting to play in front of people and wanting to get your music out there and just, yeah, that's it. I mean, it was motivation enough for us back then. You know, we were so excited to, I remember the janitor's very first show was at Rainbow Park. It's right across the street from our high school. And so we set up, there's a little like, this is like picnic kind of area, and we set up and we played, and a couple of the guys from Drippy Drawers showed up, and we were just so excited that Drippy Drawers would stop by and
Drippy Drawers.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it. Amazing. That show is somewhere out there on YouTube too, I think. It's pretty terrible.
So there is one scene that you mentioned. There's one scene that we wrote that you added a few details, and you said it came from a real story. So I want to get the real story. But basically, in our script, the band is rehearsing, and then at somebody's garage, and the cops show up and, you know, shut it down. And the cops say like, "Oh, hey, look, we got some Bon Jovis here."
Yeah, yeah.
To the kids, this punk kids playing. So that was a real thing that happened to you, right?
It happened. This wasn't the janitors. I was actually in a band before the janitors, and we're called the Nomads. And not a punk band. We had originals, but it was a lot of covers. Like we did like The Cure and REM and stuff. And I was sort of the outsider. Like they needed a keyboard player, so that they were all like older guys, friends, and they brought me in. Excuse me. And we were rehearsing in the drummer's garage. It was like early evening, and then this is pounding on the garage door. Uh-oh. Open up the garage door. There's cops. All right, you Bon Jovis, time to wrap it up. We're like, wow, Bon Jovis. That was kind of insulting. Like, we're so much cooler than Bon Jovi. He was already out of style.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about your job. You work in film and TV. What specifically is your job title?
So I'm a music editor. So in film or TV, whatever medium, anytime you hear a song or a piece of score, I'm the one that cuts it up and puts it all in the right places, or, you know, builds it up from pre-existing parts to fit in scenes and stuff like that. That's the sort of the simple description of what I do.
And you recently worked on the most recent Lilo and Stitch, right?
Yeah. I just finished that about a month ago. So we're excited about that. It's coming out Memorial Day weekend. So that's going to be a big one, I think.
Any ska in there?
No, but a lot of, no ska, but lots of cool Hawaiian music. See, I don't get to pick the songs.
Okay.
I just get to, yeah.
Well, so we won't put that on you then.
You did work on Umbrella Academy, and which famously had the Interrupters cover of Bad Guy.
So you're a tough guy, like a really rough guy, just can't get enough guy, just always so buff guy. I'm the bad type, make your mama sad type, make your girlfriend mad type, might seduce your dad type. I'm the bad guy. Duh.
You worked on that?
I did.
But you didn't pick it.
I didn't pick it. No. So sometimes they'll give me like a bin of like, you know, I don't know, 10, 15 songs and be like, let's try all these. And so it's my job to cut them up and make them like hit all the beats and you know, whatever works. So it's never my final choice, but there, you know, I definitely, if I prefer something, I might spend a little more time on.
Okay. Sidebar. This is probably totally outside of what you do. But in trailers for movies, the new thing of like taking an old song and making like a slow, sad minor key version of it for the trailer, for it or against it?
Sometimes it works and sometimes it's just really irritating. Mm-hmm. I've had to cut a few of those for shows and I'm just like, okay.
The best was I went and saw a movie the other day and, that trailer for that new movie Ballerina was playing and they did this sad minor key version of "Hold Me Closer, Tiny Dancer" while she's like kicking ass and like talking about how hard everything is.
Trailers are so funny. Trailers are their own unique world. It's like they have their own editors, their own music people, everything. Like even seeing the trailers for Lilo and Stitch, I'm like, They'll take music from a different part of the movie and put it over, you know, the scene. I'm like, that's not supposed to be there, but you know, they just, it's a different medium altogether because it's like an advertisement. You know, they're just trying to, this is a commercial. So they're just trying to make it as punchy as possible and memorable as possible.
The other trailer trend I've noticed that I also find irritating that's a little more recent is like they'll cut in like interviews with like the actors and like, oh, this is so much fun to work on this. I was like, what? Like, it's like a minute long or it's like a 30-second thing where they also have interviews too. Like, come on. It feels like you don't have stuff to show us. When I see that, I'm like, oh man, there wasn't much good stuff in there.
I kind of appreciate it though, because I like a trailer that doesn't show too much of the movie. Because if I feel like I've seen the whole movie in the trailer, I hate that.
Okay. Yeah. No, I agree with that. I feel like you shouldn't get the whole arc.
Yeah.
I definitely agree with you there.
There's also trailers that show parts of the movies that actually didn't make it into the movie.
Oh, yeah. I've noticed that.
I love that.
It pisses me off. I hate it because it's like, I remember Orange County, that Jack Black movie from 20 years ago or whatever.
Yeah.
They show the funniest scene in the trailer. And I was like, oh my God, this is going to be the best movie. And it was really funny, but I was just waiting the whole time. Like, wait, what? When is it going to happen? And it just never happened. And I was like,
well, this one's from all of our era, like Red Dawn. There's a scene that got cut out of the movie that's in the trailer where a tank runs into a McDonald's. It's in the trailer, but it's not in the movie.
I don't remember that. I remember Red Dawn.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it since it came out.
It's great. It holds up.
There's a song in the third season of Umbrella Academy. I don't know if you remember this. It's like this weird 80s German ska song. Mm. It's midway through the third season. The band is called Gier Sturflug. And the song's called Brutto Social Product.
Dann hat Oma Angst, dass zusammenbricht. Denn Opa macht heute wieder Sonderschicht. Ja, jetzt wird wieder in die Hände gespuckt. Wir steigern das Brutto Sozialprodukt. Ja, jetzt wird wieder.
Does this ring a bell? I think
I'd have to see it. I'd have to see it in context. I mean,
yeah, I think they were in Europe and it was like a chase scene.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I loved working on that show. The music was so great and the songs were, they had so many like iconic songs, and just getting to work with all stuff was a lot of fun and just a fun show. It was really well done. But I don't remember that off the top of my head, but I'm sure if I saw 2 seconds of it, I'd be like, oh yeah.
Yeah.
I do always perk up when there's a ska song. I'm always like, okay, cool.
We'll be right back after this.
When did you get started doing this?
So after Janitors, I was in a band called The Adjustments. Uh-huh.
And that went on for like 8 years, right?
Yeah, we went on for a long time, probably way longer than we should have. But it was fun. And actually, Adam, I think we played with you with Link 80.
Absolutely. I also played with you in the Aaron Carnes-less version of Flat Planet for the Bay Area Ska shows.
Bay Area Ska.
I got paid $50 a show to do those, which was Flat Planet's whole guarantee.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think I got like $5. That was a fun tour, but that was pretty wild with Slow Gherkin, and it was always fun playing with those guys.
Yeah.
So Adjustments kind of fizzled out, and I got, you know, we had toured pretty relentlessly for 5 or 6 years, and one day we were about to play a show. I think it was actually a record release party. And I was just like, this is it for me. I'm done. I was just done. And I haven't played live since. I just couldn't take it anymore. It was time to try to find something else. So I went back to school to try to be a film composer. Huh. And great program. And one of the classes was music editing for film and television. And I was like, what's this? And I just took, you know, it's an elective. I just took it randomly. And the professor was a music editor, and I asked her if she ever needed any help, you know, to let me know. She said, actually, I could use an assistant. And so I just sort of got my foot in the door that way. And she showed me the ropes, and I just went off on my own. And it's a tough business to break into, especially now. It's not the healthiest industry, especially in California.
Yeah.
It's just a lot of, you know, networking and just like really just being persistent and finally you know, you get to a point where you build up enough where you can make a living out of it. So I said, I think I'm going to stick with this.
Yeah. But backing up just a little bit, in that class, what year was that class?
That was probably like 2005, maybe.
Okay. So not like super long ago, but 20 years ago. What was the software you were using to edit audio for that class? Or were you even using audio? Was it Pro Tools?
Yeah. Pro Tools. Still Pro Tools to this day. It's always been, I got into it right after they stopped using actual physical tape.
Wow.
Which I count my blessings for.
Yeah.
I mean, I still work with people that are, you know, we're working in the tape era, and it's, I mean, you're literally like cutting tape with razor blades and taping it together. And, you know, I mean, what a painstaking process. Nowadays it's just, you can just do so much more and so much faster.
Yeah. I went back to college around the same time, and I went to San Jose State and I studied film, and similar, I got in right when the whole department had like digital cameras. And so I didn't have to go through the whole like learning analog first only to be told like, this is not relevant anymore. Now you have to learn digital. So I got to like, just go straight to digital.
Yeah. It's funny. I was talking to a composer I work with, and I said, you know, I noticed there's not a lot of old music editors. And he said, yeah, that's because when it went to digital, they all retired. So that's a good point. Yeah. Like, you know, I can imagine, you know, just having to learn a whole new way of doing your job. It had to be a pretty big turnoff for a lot of people, you know?
Okay. So I got some random janitors / you know, that era questions. First one, I remember when Tantra Monsters were on tour. I think you must have been in LA at that point, because I remember Kevin Dill from Skank and Pickles Roadie told me that you got on stage with Tantra Monsters and played the Doogie Howser theme song.
I probably did. I saw them at Slim's.
Oh, okay. So maybe it was in LA. I can't remember.
Did they tour more than once in the US?
I just remember they did a full like full tour, like a 2-month tour. Yeah.
Yeah. So the Doogie Howser theme was a janitor's, one of our onstage bits too. So maybe somebody requested it and I just said, sure, I'll do that. I was pretty ballsy back then. I didn't really have any, like, you know, didn't have, I was happy to jump on any stage and pretty much do anything, you know?
Yeah.
But nowadays I'm just like, I'm good.
Now, what about the Decepticons? You had toured with the Decepticons. Was that with janitors or with adjustments?
That was adjustments. That was our first national tour. And it was fun. It was a lot of fun. Those guys are great. And, George was so awesome. Like, he's so talented. I just remember being in awe at his talent. He's the guitar player for Decepticons, and he went on to be in the Pie Tasters and then
Loving Poppers. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. He was awesome. I just like to hang out with him, and he'd sit there and play Beatles songs and sing along, and, you know, he could play anything, you know, just off the top of his head. It was pretty cool. And we also bonded over Crab Rangoon. That was the ME330 album. The janitors were on the Crab Rangoon tour with what's the Chicago band?
Slapstick?
Yes, it was Slapstick, ME330, and janitors. That was a lot of fun. But I loved that album so much when it came out, because
yeah,
the one thing that always bothered me about ska and ska punk was that it was always really goofy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, janitors included. And that's when I started to realize, okay, I can write stuff that's more actually like from the heart, and still be in a band like this. And, that album really changed a lot for me.
Yeah.
So we bonded over that, and they were in this giant school bus, purple school bus, the Decepticons, just driving around the nation. It was pretty funny.
Adam knows all about that school bus, right?
Famously dissed by Animal Chin by the song FTDB, Fuck the Decepticons Bus.
Real quick, like circling back to our script.
Yeah.
We kind of based the main character off of you, but to what degree was like that really your childhood? I mean, the character in the script is like, has a family that's divorced, a mom that's alcoholic, and he's kind of just left to his own devices. Was that your childhood, or is that an exaggeration of your childhood?
It's not my childhood. It's sort of, I mean, there's aspects that are my childhood. My parents were not divorced and my mom was not alcoholic, but my best friends lived those realities. Mm-hmm. And so this character is, it's, there's parts of it that are definitely me 100%, but I wanted to make it more representative of a kid from that era in the South Bay who was playing a punk band, because that was a common story, you know, and, you know, much more interesting than my family. But just also, I mean, I witnessed the lives of these kids, you know, and the difficulties that they went through. And a lot of the things in the script are actually memories that I have of being in their homes, you know, hanging out and witnessing their troubles and their hardships. It was pretty brutal.
But some of the part where, like, you did kind of have that sort of like freedom to just go off as a young kid and do whatever, right?
Yeah. We were completely feral. Even before we could drive, you know, we'd ride our bikes everywhere. The South Bay is super flat, so you can ride your bike anywhere, you know, within a 10-mile radius. So we'd ride our bikes up to Campbell, up to, you know, Taco Bravo and the record shops and stuff, and, you know, Tower Records and Streetlight Records, and we just go everywhere on our bikes or take the bus. I mean, I remember being like 10 years old and just like hopping on the Santa Clara County Transit to Great America from my house, totally unsupervised, hanging out there all day and taking the bus home, and, you know, stuff we would never let kids do nowadays. Yeah, we just roamed the streets, and it was pretty wild.
I mean, I've talked to many of our peers who had that existence, but I didn't have that. I don't think, Adam, you didn't either, really, right?
What, being feral?
Yeah.
Yeah. Dude, I rode the bus from Gilroy up to San Jose.
As a kid?
I mean, as a young teen, like a young teen.
Okay.
And even, I mean, that was the first time I wanted to go anywhere. Like, when I was younger, I was just out on my bike, like down in the creek.
Like, yeah.
Completely unsupervised.
We would, we had all these drainage ditches and creeks. Mm. And like, we quickly realized, you know, they would run under the major like roads, right? Mm-hmm. And we quickly realized the fastest way from point A to point B was sometimes to go through those tunnels. Mm-hmm. And they were like you couldn't just walk through those tunnels. You had to like get down sometimes on all fours, or sometimes just like crouching as low as you could. And it was pitch black. You know, you'd find like homeless encampments or people's like stashes and stuff. And like, but that was, you know, we'd hop the fence and take the tunnels, because that was the fastest way to go around sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. In Gilroy, like the older neighborhoods, there were alleys that ran down the back, like between the houses for like garbage collection. And we would take those to get places, which, you know, end up being kind of sketchy sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah, you never knew what you're getting yourself into. Yeah. Luckily, we never had any major issues. But yeah, I mean, I think we were sort of the first generation where both parents worked, you know, full time. Mm-hmm. And so we were responsible for getting ourselves up in the morning, getting ourselves to school, you know, making sure all our homework was done. And then just, you know, in the afternoon, we're just sort of free to roam.
Yeah.
And we did.
And then we got a little older. Ska punk.
That's right.
what was your introduction? I mean, you're a horn player, right? What was your introduction to ska?
It was when I joined the Janitors.
Yeah?
They wanted horn players, and I was already friends with a couple of the guys. And they introduced me to like Skank and Pickle, Mighty Mighty Boss Tones, Specials, Mr. Bungle had, you know, a lot of ska punk elements, these ska elements, when the first record came out. Who else were we listening to? Fishbone, of course. Yeah, I just sort of got like introduced to all this music at once, and I was just blown away. I said, what is that? I can actually play this. I'm a sax player. This is so great. You know, I had already played keyboard too, but it just felt like, you know, accessible and fun, and, you know, the voice of a, you know, the voice inside the head of a 15-year-old, you know, kid. So just took to it strongly.
So from the beginning, the idea was like, let's make this band as crazy as possible.
Pretty much. It just, yeah. I mean, we were all just weird kids. So it was like, what's the weirdest thing we could, it wasn't even like, what's the weirdest thing we could do? We would just do weird things, mm-hmm. you know? It was never necessarily like a goal. It's just sort of who we were. We were all just these weirdos, you know? And we sort of fed off each other's weirdness, and that was sort of the result. It was weird songs.
I just remember janitors played, you guys played so fast.
Yeah.
Everything was really fast. And then your drummer, I only know him as Donnie.
Yeah.
Just kind of sloppy, but like also really playing really cool parts. And like,
yeah,
like something about the way that they played was really appealing to me. Cause it felt like kind of the Op Ivy style of like playing ska punk drums, like kind of rudimentary, but also like frenetic.
Well, Donnie was a punk, and he was not a drummer, and he originally was playing, I think, guitar or bass, and then our bass player joined, and he's like, okay, I'll move to drums, because we didn't have a drummer, mm-hmm. but he had no experience playing drums, so he just was winging it. I mean, literally, he had never played drums before, so he was just trying to keep up, and Pete, our guitar player, just played so, his upbeats were so fast. I don't remember any other band playing that fast.
Yeah.
But Pete was a really good guitar player, still is. And he just played so fast. And so we all just sort of tried to keep up with it. And yeah. And then Donnie left about the same time that MC Loaf left. He went on to be in like emo bands and stuff, mm-hmm. Which was really more what he was into. I don't think he ever really liked ska.
But the way that MC Loaf sang, was that always the thing?
I don't think that was planned, honestly. I think, if I'm being completely straightforward, I think he was self-conscious about his singing voice. Mm-hmm. And so he decided, like, singing that way, people couldn't say, oh, this singer sucks. They'd just be like, whoa, what is going on with this singer? He's so weird, you know? So I think it came out of his self-consciousness for him.
I see.
I don't want to speak out of turn, but if I remember correctly, I'm pretty sure that was what was going on. And so we actually encouraged him to, like, not just sing, like, you can sing. I mean, his voice was still kind of weird, but like, he could sing in tune. He could keep a tune. But I think he just adopted that style and just sort of ran with it. Cause he was in bands later. You could hear those records. He's singing, you know, he could do it. So it just became part of the whole circus.
Thank you for listening to In Defense of Ska. To support the show, sign up for our Patreon. Intro and outro music by Slow Gherkin from the EP Lives. Additional music by Dan P. and the Bricks. Please rate and review the podcast and tell a friend. Follow at In Defense of Ska on social media. The book In Defense of Ska by Aaron Carnes is available from Clash Books. Order it online. Chris Reeves of SPI is our editor. This is your co-host, Adam Davis of Omnigon, leaving you by saying ska now more than ever. Hey, Aaron, if people want to hear more of our conversation with Lodge Wuster, what should they do?
Well, what they should do, and even if they don't want to hear more, is they should go to the In Defense of Ska Patreon and hit, you know, subscribe or whatever they call it in Patreon terms.
Sure.
Yeah, just sign up, listen to the full episode, listen to the entire back catalog, and you know, if you feel like following the Patreon after this podcast is over, you can continue to do so. And I will continue to keep you updated on what I'm up to, the new book I'm writing. And I'll even tell you what Adam's doing. And I'll maybe even put pictures of him on there.
So kind.
Yeah, very, like, with clothes, probably.
Oh, wow. Just took a turn.
Depends on the tier you're at.
Yeah. So sign up, In Defense of Ska, onlyfans.com/InDefenseOfSka. I mean, patreon.com/InDefenseOfSka.
Are you a financial advisor considering the independent RIA model and wondering where to start? Start with Schwab Advisor Services. They've helped thousands evaluate the full range of options and can help you determine your best path forward. Start your journey today at advisorservices.schwab.com/paths.